We'll proceed to the third case of the day, Ricardo versus Roush. Ms. Welch.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. The jury found that Lieutenant Roush had violated the plaintiff's rights here, the Eighth Amendment rights. But this case never should have gone to trial in the first place because the plaintiff failed to comply with the mandatory prerequisite for filing this complaint, which was to exhaust his administrative remedies. And alternatively, it should never have gone to the jury because on this record, the plaintiff failed to establish each essential element of his case. And lastly, even if there had not been a failure to exhaust, and if the case should have gone to the jury, there should be a new trial on liability or at least on damages. The threshold question here is, in fact, exhaustion under the Prison Litigation Reform Act. And the Supreme Court has said quite explicitly that all prisoners who are seeking redress for circumstances, events that occur in prisons, must comply with the Prison Litigation Reform Act. They must exhaust their remedies, their formal administrative remedies. Now, the plaintiff has and the district court agreed that plaintiff had done so by filing the February 98 grievance. The problem with this grievance, however, is that it does not satisfy the PLRA's purpose, which is to alert, its central purpose, which is to alert prison authorities of the nature of a controversy and allow them to respond to it and to develop a record about it.
But we generally don't require prisoners to plead facts and legal theories in their grievance. So why isn't his statement that the assault occurred because the administration, which has to include Roush, didn't do its job in a sufficient manner to prompt an investigation?
No,
that's not,
I don't believe, Your Honor, that's what the grievance says. The grievance is about the administration not pursuing criminal charges against Garcia. It's not about not having an investigation. In fact, there was an investigation into the assault itself. There was medical evidence taken and so on, and there was a polygraph test was administered, and they did conclude that the assault had occurred. What the grievance procedure here had to do under McCoy was to alert the administration that there was a problem about Lieutenant Roush's conduct, that he had violated the prison policy of honoring housing refusals. And because this problem wasn't brought to the administration's attention, it couldn't either try to remedy it in-house in some way, discipline Lieutenant Roush, get to the bottom of this, take evidence. For example, and this has created a significant problem here because, as Lieutenant Roush testified, he does these transfers hundreds of times. And, you know, to be asked 2 years later to remember one particular transfer is just not reasonable. This, again, is the purpose that Congress had in mind when it passed the PLRA. One of the purposes it had to pass the PLRA. And there's simply no exceptions to this requirement, and the plaintiffs didn't meet it. I mean, this is the threshold question. The district court should have dismissed the case at this point, at this juncture, and it didn't. The plaintiff also suggested this informal complaint satisfied it, that there's some sort of substantial compliance component to the PLRA. But this court...
Counsel, I have some trouble reconciling your argument with the holding in Strong that exhaustion does not depend on the demand for specific relief. Your argument seems to be that in order to exhaust one's remedies, the prisoner has to demand specific relief against a specific named person.
No, Your Honor.
Strong doesn't support that proposition. Indeed, it contradicts it.
Your Honor, our argument isn't necessarily that, although this court held and found their grievance insufficient in McCoy more recently because the prisoner had not said that it was about staff misconduct, and that's exactly what happened here. The grievance, the February 98 grievance, is not about staff misconduct. He also didn't, in McCoy, the plaintiff didn't say his grievance was insufficient because he didn't say he was going to sue and that he wanted money. And here, this is exactly the same deficiencies in this particular grievance here. And also, the notion that a futility notion of money isn't really part of the equation here, because Booth said quite explicitly, it doesn't matter what...
Do you want to discuss how Strong bears on your argument?
Your Honor, I think to the extent that Strong implies that you don't have to ask for money, I'm not saying you have to ask for money, although this court did indicate in McClure more recently that yes, you do have to notify the institution of the nature of what it is that you want. Because, for example, if a plaintiff says, if a prisoner indicated in a grievance, all I want is for you to discipline Lieutenant Rausch, then and there had been discipline, then that would have resolved the problem here. The problem is that this grievance didn't say that the plaintiff wanted anything about Lieutenant Rausch.
No, but that's the type of language he uses in the complaint. I expect action taken. Bring this animal before the judge and jury. This is uncalled for. I mean, he's calling for a criminal investigation. Shouldn't that be enough to prompt the institution to conduct an investigation and put them on the notice that there was some problem in terms of how this assault occurred?
About Lieutenant Rausch?
Yes.
No, I think that...
I mean, it doesn't name him, but certainly it would prompt investigation and put them on notice that they should search or they should try to identify what was going on in terms of this incident.
What this says is that the administration didn't do its job in pushing criminal proceedings to be brought against Garcia. It doesn't indicate that there was any problem with staff misconduct. And that's the problem here. If there had been some indication that there was a staff problem, instead that this was, as we argue, a random sexual assault under the evidence in this case, then there would have been an investigation into staff misconduct. But the problem, again, is that there wasn't anything in this grievance to alert the institution that that one cause of this incident was, in fact, Lieutenant Rausch's conduct in deciding to sell Garcia with the plaintiff. I mean, there's simply nothing in this grievance. And in fact, at the trial, the plaintiff himself testified without any... testified quite explicitly that this grievance had nothing to do with Lieutenant Rausch. So if the plaintiff himself thinks that this grievance had nothing to do with Lieutenant Rausch, then surely it wouldn't have put the institution on notice that it had something to do with Lieutenant Rausch. And again, if the plaintiff's grievance had something to do with Lieutenant Rausch, it could have been investigated and helped, in fact, Lieutenant Rausch figure out what happened here. Lieutenant Rausch, 2 years later, cannot have any memory of this, and it surely impedes his ability to defend his case. Again, Congress intended to both limit the suits that would come up, to prevent suits, to fix particular problems, to provide some responsive action. And this grievance, the plaintiff himself said he wasn't looking for a responsive action for Lieutenant Rausch's conduct. So in that regard, this grievance in particular simply cannot satisfy the PLRA under McCoy, and even under, I think, a proper reading of Strong.
Does the grievance form call for, have a line dealing with staff misconduct?
There's a checkoff at the top.
And that did not occur here, right?
Correct. That's true, Your Honor. Right. So, right, and again, in no way was there an alert, even in that small way. If there had just, even if plaintiff had said, one of the guards didn't listen to me. I mean, so what he says here, one of the guards didn't listen to me. I told him there was going to be a hit, and he put me in the cell anyway. That would have alerted that kind of just not naming the guard, not saying even I want money from this, but somehow alerting the institution to the problem, to the cause of the problem, so that it can respond to that cause. And because this is a mandatory precondition for suit, it had the action had to be dismissed and has to be dismissed for failure to comply with this. Because, again, at bottom, it's the purpose of the PLRA is to give the institution fair notice, and this grievance did not do that. Now, turning to the merits with regard to the judgment as a matter of law, there are two key components here, two legal questions. One was, that was there objectively speaking, a substantial risk of harm. And the second significant legal question is causation. With regard to the first, even if one accepts, as the district court did, that there was a substantial risk of a hit, a Latin King hit, that night from selling Garcia with the plaintiff, that substantial risk ended once the placement offices took over responsibility for selling decisions. In addition, the problem here is that the hit, there's no connection, there's no evidentiary connection between sexual assault here and the hit.
What do we know about the number of sexual assaults at this prison annually, for example?
There's nothing in the record to support that there's any problem with sexual assault.
Wasn't put in at trial?
No, Your Honor, there was not.
In determining whether there's an objectively serious risk, doesn't one need to know the number of incidents similar to this and the number of harms that result?
I think that...
You would think one side or the other would find this important evidence.
Well, Your Honor, I think the more important evidence, though, would be whether there's evidence that this particular person presented a risk of sexual assault, not whether there's a general problem with sexual assault. Otherwise, you couldn't sell people together at all. And so here, the question is whether there was an objective risk of this sexual assault. Well, the only evidence about the sexual assault is that suddenly, on the day of the incident, in the afternoon, Mr. Garcia started talking about fantasies and how he needed to fulfill...
There are two pieces of data that might be helpful. One is the aggregate number of sexual assaults, and the other is the number of inmates who are put together despite their protests. And we could figure out from that how many people who are still together despite their protests are effectively crying wolf, and how many... what percentage of these protests was well-grounded. But if the data aren't in the record, they just aren't there.
No, Your Honor, they're not. And this would be something that the plaintiff would have to, I believe, come up with, because he would have to show that there was an objective risk, because when you put people together, it's highly probable that an assault will occur. And he didn't put, there's no evidence that that Garcia was a sexual predator. There's no evidence that Garcia had these fantasies. Nobody knew about them, certainly, until he started voicing them on the day of the incident. And this leads to a causation problem here. The plaintiff was the only person I noticed that Garcia had these sexual fantasies, and yet he didn't alert anybody to that this could be a problem. And also, the plaintiff, even though he made many efforts, he says, in writing grievances and so on, so that he could get out of the cell, the moment he was offered an opportunity to get out of the cell, he didn't take it. And just like the prisoner in Benner, just like the prisoner in Burrell, if you have an opportunity to get out and you don't take it, you've interrupted the chain of causation. Lastly, just with regard to the new trial, the plaintiff has waived any objection to a new trial on liability because they didn't address it in their brief. But, and also on damages, just to say, the damages awards to which the district court and the plaintiff are trying to compare this award don't have comparable plaintiffs, don't have comparable evidence of injury, particularly post-event injury, psychological injury. There's no evidence that the plaintiff ever sought psychological counseling while he was out of jail and so on. So for those reasons, we ask that the court reverse the judgment here on PLRA grounds or on evidentiary grounds, and at the very least grant a new trial on both. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wells. Mr. Chemerinsky?
Good morning. The jury in this case found that Anthony Ricardo was sexually and physically assaulted and suffered great injuries due to deliberate indifference of Larry Rausch. The district court, after carefully reviewing the evidence, upheld that jury verdict. This court should affirm. With regard to the first issue, exhaustion under the Prison Litigation Reform Act, our primary contention is that the exhaustion requirement was met here. The primary argument of the state is that the grievance wasn't sufficiently specific. I have two responses to that. First, the grievance was sufficiently specific under this court's decision in Strong v. David. And second, that the state waived this objection by not in any way proceeding with regard to the administrative action that was taken in this case. With regard to the first argument, in terms of the degree of specificity, this court in Strong v. David specifically said all the grievant need do is object intelligibly to some shortcoming. Quoting, all the grievant must do is alert the prison to the nature of the wrong for which redress is sought.
Now, Professor, just stopping at that point, how do we distinguish this from any other sexual assault where the complaint is about the act and doesn't go any further? How are we going to cabin this case so that we don't, or unless you would suggest we go further, that any assault should place on notice the potential of staff shortcomings?
Here the question is, did the grievance give notice to the prison of what occurred? And I focus your attention to the very language of the grievance here. It says, quote, he then sexually assaulted me. He describes what happened. He says, the administration didn't do its job. In the last sentence of the handwritten grievance, he says, my family and I plan legal action in these matters. The state repeatedly refers to the McCoy case, but the McCoy case was a pre-PLRA case where there was no grievance filed, and this court said in those circumstances there's requirements. When you're dealing with the grievances here, Strong versus David is the case on point. As Judge Williams pointed out, there's not a fact pleading requirement when it comes to a prisoner filing a grievance.
No question. My concern is how are we going to, wouldn't that be the language in any time there's a sexual assault? How are we going to parse it to suggest that because I'm going to bring legal action or my family will, that suggests staff shortcoming? That's my only suggestion. Unless you take the position all assaults cause the institution to reflect upon a potential staff shortcoming.
I think that there is a requirement on the part of the grievance to give an indication that there's a concern about the staff. But he did so here, and I quote you the exact language, the administration didn't do its job. There isn't a requirement, according to Strong versus David, that he point to specifically the name of the guard.
The question is whether its job means penalizing the aggressor after the fact or preventing the assault from happening before the fact. The language of the grievance certainly sounds like its concern is the former, that the aggressor hadn't received enough penalty.
But there isn't a requirement that the grievance specify the relief sought in that way. Again, I quote the opinion in Strong v. David. No administrative system may demand that the prisoner specify each remedy later sought in litigation. It's sufficient here that the prisoner said, I was sexually assaulted because the prison didn't do its job. It's clear here that he...
No. But that's the interpretive question. Does this grievance properly read say, I was sexually assaulted because the administration didn't do its job, or I was sexually assaulted and after that the administration didn't do its job?
I think it's the former. He's saying here that the administration didn't protect him. You'll notice at the beginning of the grievance he talks about how he was raped in Cook County Jail. He had let the prison know of this, and still the prison did not provide him protection. There is a second reason why this grievance is specific, and that's that the state here did not respond to the grievance. Though he filed a timely appeal on March 5th, 1998, though the state was required to respond within 40 days, it didn't. And this court said in Lewis v. Washington, I quote, that a grievance is exhausted when prison officials fail to respond to inmate grievances. The reason that this is so important, Your Honors, is that if the state was concerned about the ambiguity, including the ambiguity that Judge Easterbrook raises, it could have said so at that point if he had amended his grievance. But when the state chose not to respond at all, he didn't have that opportunity. The state just said, well, this happened 2 years later. Lieutenant Roush didn't remember. But had the state administrative proceedings responded in a timely way, then Lieutenant Roush would have had the opportunity to respond. The state that fell down by not responding, under this court's precedent, that's sufficient. I would move to the second issue, that the deliberate indifference of Lieutenant Roush caused the injuries that were suffered here. It's important to focus on what happened with regard to deliberate indifference.
Okay, let me ask you what my same kind of question I was asking your adversary. My principal concern about the objective seriousness of the risk. It seems to me one cannot determine the objective seriousness of the risk ex ante, which is the right question, just by looking at what happens ex post. And some people who drive their car well under the speed limit nonetheless have accidents. So we need to know some data ex ante. What is there in this record which would indicate that ex ante the risk was high?
First, that evidence couldn't be in the record because almost surely the district court judge wouldn't let plaintiff present evidence of other sexual assaults on the grounds that it would be more prejudicial than probative. And second, Your Honor...
Wait. The plaintiff offered data and that data were rejected?
No, the plaintiff didn't because the plaintiff thought that it would be unlikely that such data would be accepted and because it's unnecessary.
I'm not persuaded by the argument. No evidence was offered because the plaintiff was sure that an objection would be sustained. That's not the way the judicial system works.
But
you got to offer the evidence.
It's unnecessary here, Your Honor, and the reason is that here Ricardo said to Roush, my life will be in danger.
I understand what he said, but many people do not perceive their risks accurately. The question I'm asking is, what is the correlation between such perceptions and actual risk? If there's a good correlation, then obviously guards have to respond to it. If there's a poor correlation, then guards don't have to respond to it. We need some data to figure out whether there's a good correlation, a poor correlation, or no correlation.
I disagree that that data is required because Illinois has a prison regulation and a practice that if an inmate tells
a violated state law, that's fine, but that's not the Eighth Amendment. Let's stick to the Eighth Amendment. Let me put it differently. Would it be right to say that the Eighth Amendment just has as an absolute principle that any prisoner can object to any potential cellmate and that objection must be honored?
If a prisoner says to a guard, my life is in danger having this person in the
mm-hmm.
cell, then for the prison guard to falsely tell the prisoner, you have no choice, and to ask the prisoner in front of the other inmate that is a danger,
but
and put them together.
The question I'm asking is not the facts of this case. It's a general rule. If that is the general rule, then any prisoner who wants a single cell, which is, I think, all prisoners, will say every time, I perceive my life is in danger. And on this view, as a matter of constitutional law, the guard cannot disagree with the prisoner's professed assessment. Now, if it turns out, as I said, if it turns out that there's a very strong correlation between prisoners saying that and actual risk, then maybe that has to be the rule. But if instead what we discover is the prisoners routinely say that as a means of getting what they want, and therefore the objective risk is small, then one couldn't have such a rule.
But here
that's where I'm wondering what we know about what the objective risk is.
But here, Your Honor, the practice of Illinois is important in assessing whether there's deliberate indifference. What Illinois says here is if the prisoner says my life's in danger...
You're not helping me. Maybe one of my colleagues will find that persuasive, but both the Supreme Court and we have said over and over and over that not complying with state law does not violate the federal constitution.
And I'm not
Illinois can go beyond the federal constitution if it wants.
Yes, but all I was trying to explain is that what Illinois would say is that what's appropriate is that the prisoner be placed in an administrative segregation until the risk can be assessed. And the reason why that's the appropriate standard is when a prisoner says that my life is in danger, something should be done about it. And
why? That just begs the question. If prisoners say that strategically to get what they want without there being objective risk, then I don't see why prisons have to respond to it. But if that statement is objectively an indicator of high risk, then prisons must respond to it. And that's why I'm trying to figure out whether that kind of statement by a prisoner is objectively an indicator of high risk.
Your Honor, the reason that I disagree with your assessment here is prisoners have obviously no ability to protect themselves, the court said in Farmer versus Brennan. The prisoner says, my life will be in danger. Any responsible prison guard at that point should take action. And here,
that just assumes the answer to my question. You're assuming in giving that answer that the risk is objectively high rather than that the prisoner is being manipulative. And I just don't know where we get the answer to that question.
Yeah.
One of these hypotheses is true.
The question is, given that what we know about prisoners, that there are hits on prisoners,
yeah,
that there is violence, that there are sexual assaults.
How much? That's right. I guess I'm not going to get anywhere because the record doesn't
say. The record doesn't say, and of course, no court in the country has ever said that in order for a prisoner to recover, the prisoner has to present evidence to show that there's a high pattern of sexual assault and violence in prison.
The Supreme Court standard is the prisoner must show objectively substantial risk. And that's where I got in. Showing a bad outcome ex post does not imply high risk ex ante. You need something else to show a high risk ex ante.
Well, here didn't we have a situation where in addition to telling Roush about the hit, he also told Roush he had requested not being housed with Garcia, and he informed Roush that another prison official had told him that he was not going to put Garcia in Ricardo's cell. So that other prison official had done some assessment.
That's correct. Lieutenant Armand said that Ricardo would not be put in the cell with Garcia. What Lieutenant Roush did at that point was say falsely to Ricardo that you can't refuse this assignment, there's no other alternative, and then brought the two prisoners together to ask them in front of each
right,
other.
Right, and he admitted that that wasn't reasonable, bringing
that's
him
right
in front of the person who was possibly put the hit on it.
That's right. And that's really the issue in this case, and where I think we would disagree with Judge Easterbrook, is the need to prove a pattern of sexual assault in a particular prison, given what we know about prisons generally. Finally, with regard to the last issue, of course we don't waive the objections to new trial. The argument in appellant's brief for a new trial was the exact same as the arguments about deliberate indifference and qualified immunity we'd addressed. And we argue with regard to the damages here, the standard says that a district court upholding a jury verdict can only be overturned for abuse of discretion. A jury verdict of damages should only be overturned for being monstrously excessive. Given the enormous injuries that Ricardo suffered, the physical and psychological injuries, the damage award here should stand. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairman. Ms. Walsh?
Thank you, Your Honor. With regard to Strong versus David and Judge Easterbrook's question about the applicability of that, and the plaintiff argued that this case applies, what Strong says, though, is that you have to, you know, alert the institution as to the nature of the wrong for which redress is sought. And the nature of the wrong that this grievance sought redress for was the lack of criminal charges being brought against Garcia. And the redress he sought for that is in his remedy.
And that assumes that this was a request for action ex post. If there's this ambiguity, whether the complaint has to do with failure to prevent or failure to punish, the two possible readings, shouldn't we say the prison is obliged to read it both ways? Or at least that exhaustion has occurred if the prison could read it both ways?
Your Honor, this grievance can...
Or resolve the ambiguity against the prisoner?
Your Honor, there is no ambiguity here. The plaintiff himself testified this grievance has nothing to do with Lieutenant Roush. That's his testimony. That was his intent. And so if he had any intent that it would be about Lieutenant Roush, he would have said that. And also, there's the redress that he actually sought is, you know, this animal should face a judge and a jury. He's talking about Garcia. The injury he saw was that he had not, that Garcia had not been brought to a judge and jury, and that's the injury that he alerted the institution
what
to. There was no ambiguity here.
Ms. Walsh, following up on Judge Easterbrook's inquiry, what would be wrong in reading every complaint that focuses on the attack by the cellmate as an indication that at least preliminarily the institution should think about the original assignment? Is that some burden that the state shouldn't have to assume? I'm thinking of this case in particular,
right,
where you have a grievous sexual assault. Should not the original assignment be a subject that automatically would become under review?
Not if the grievance doesn't alert the institution.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Does the act itself alert? I mean, I appreciate your emphasis on where the focus seems to have been placed by Ricardo, but I'm just concerned about turning a deaf ear to where there's an aggravated circumstance like this, and there's the understandable angst and anger at the perpetrator. I don't want to misread that statement as not having saying something about I shouldn't have been in with him. And you just feel that implication has no bounds. Is that if I'm right in suggesting that maybe it ought to be always read as a complaint about assignment, original assignment?
Well, what I'm saying is that even under Strong, that a grievance has to alert the institution as to the nature of the problem that they're looking for redress. And that to add on another obligation to an institution.
Well, I mean, he clearly would be asking the institution not to put me in with another sexual predator, right?
That's certainly the reasonable inference. I think
right.
that you would that certainly they would be alerted to, and the institution was already alerted to the prior sexual assault, and it was taking steps to protect him in that regard, and he had seen Bloomquist and so on, and they were taking steps for that. So the institution was attuned to that, but again, you have to remember there was no evidence in the record to support the notion that Garcia was a sexual predator, and his sexual tendencies, his fantasies, only came to light the day of the incident. And the plaintiff didn't alert the institution to that. Again, I see my time is up.
I just have one other question.
Oh, sorry.
The language in the complaint, when he talks about the administration don't do their jobs, I mean, everything before that talks about the sexual assault and the fact that an officer passed by right before the assault occurred. So even that portion of the complaint doesn't talk about, you know, getting redressed in front of the jury. You know, he talks about that later on. So, I mean, why can't we interpret that as putting the prison on notice when you look at it in the context of what's gone before?
Well, maybe on notice that some guard had walked by, but
he talks about the administration and, you know, they were to blame. So, I mean, I think it could be construed more broadly than that. I'm saying at least he made reference to someone, even though he didn't know the name, he made some reference to a prison official.
But that's 2 days, a prison official who acted or didn't act 2 days later, and who there's no evidence that when that guard, I mean, and the plaintiff at trial said, you know, he didn't see, that guard didn't see, couldn't see because the lights were out. And so, I mean, he's not saying that guard was at fault. I don't think what he's saying here is that the administration, when they were disciplining Garcia, should have gone the distance, should have referred it for criminal charges. And we actually don't know if they did, and the state's attorney just didn't follow through. What we do know is that apparently there were no criminal charges brought. But that was the problem. That was the nature of the wrong that he was looking at here. And to start to impose a duty on institutions to be clairvoyant about grievances would really expand and I think undermine the purpose of the PLRA, which again is to alert an institution to a specific wrong and try to remedy that specific wrong.
Well, if the state had responded to his grievance in a timely fashion, then perhaps any ambiguity would have come out.
Again, Your Honor, I don't think there's any ambiguity, and the plaintiff testified there's no ambiguity. He said this has nothing to do with Lieutenant Rausch. So I don't think, you know, given plaintiff's very explicit testimony, it would be contrary to the evidence to read this as ambiguous. I see my time is still up, so we ask that the court reverse or remand for a new trial.
Thanks. Well, thanks to all counsel. Case taken.